We've been sold the idea that financial independence is all about some number on your account statement. Or even worse, that you don't qualify because of where you started out. That's just not true. It's not about some well-kept secret of the wealthy. It's about finding the right information and knowing how to apply it. On the Get Ready for the Future show, we're answering your questions so you can start making real financial change today. The journey to true financial independence begins right here, and it starts with you.
Coming to you from GenWealth's West Little Rock office on the sixth floor of 3 Financial Center, this is the Get Ready for the Future show. Glad to have you along. My name is Scott Inman, along with GenWealth co-founder John Shrewsberry. For today's show, I mentioned the West Little Rock office. We've got 5 of them in Little Rock and 1 in Louisiana. GenWealth Financial Advisors with advisors in all of those offices to help people discover, protect, and share true financial independence. And John, we're on the air here on radio and podcast and online to help people make better money decisions that can lead them on that path. And, you know, this is our mission statement at GenWealth. And before we dive into the question and answer portion, I think it's cool to unpack this mission statement once in a while. So we say that we help people discover, protect, and share true financial independence. As we walk through those 3 things, I love discover because that's basically indicating that it's already out there to be found, right?
Yeah.
Right? It's within reach.
It is. Most people are concerned about, you know, whether or not they're just going to make it day to day. They don't really often stop and go, okay, can I become financially independent? But we believe that every person has the opportunity to become financially independent if they have the right information and they have income to actually generate that financial independence. We can help to guide them in that direction. Financial independence is something that is very, very elusive to people. And if you don't have a guide, Scott, I think that there's a much lower chance of you getting to that stage of financial independence.
Yeah, and the protect part of that statement is once you have achieved it, you've got to do things to keep it.
Got to hang on to it. Yeah. You've got to be able to say, okay, this is going to carry me through for the rest of my life. I think that goes back to the definition of what financial independence actually is. It is the ability to live without a paycheck for the rest of your life and not have to worry about where your money's coming from.
Yep.
Now, there's a lot of people that live without a paycheck, but they do so in maybe all kinds of different ways. But this is a way of building up your assets, discovering that you have that opportunity, building up those assets, then maintaining those assets in such a way that you can also think about living not just paycheck to paycheck, but also increasing that income over time so you've got the opportunity to keep ahead of inflation.
So you've got to have a plan to protect your own financial independence, and that covers your own life, but at some point you have the opportunity to share true financial independence. And I think that part of our mission statement really has a dual meaning. It's sharing it in the way that you would think of transferring your assets to the next generation once you're gone and giving them a leg up on their financial independence, but it's also the education component. Once you've achieved it and you're in your financial independence living it out, then you can do things to pass on to friends, neighbors, next generation, whoever it is, and that comes back to the education piece of this show.
Yeah, it absolutely does. The education piece of this show helps you to understand all of the details of what you've done from a financial independence standpoint so you can convey those to other people and then get them started on the journey as well. And then if you think about this whole idea of transferring your wealth to the next generation, to your family and what have you, most people think, well, that's pretty easy. I just sign a beneficiary form and everything's done. No, not necessarily so. That is a complex area that we're wading into with our clients with some help from outside of GenWealth, from experts that know about the transference of wealth and the legal implications thereof. Those are all things that we help you walk through with one stop here at GenWealth Financial Advisors.
Yeah, so that is our mission statement. It's why we exist and why we work for our clients, but it is also why we do this program. And John has been on the air for a very long time with this show, the Get Ready for the Future show, and that's what it's about. It's getting ready for your financial future. And a year or so ago, a couple of years ago, I guess now, we changed to a format of taking your questions. We want you to get your questions to us. It's easy to do that. You can call 501-381-5228 and leave us a voicemail. Just ask the question on the voicemail. You can shoot us a text at that number. You can also send an email to show@getreadyforthefuture.com. Anything that's on your mind, money related, and we'll take it on. Just like Dontell from Little Rock did. Here's our first question on today's show. What do I need to know when trying to decide to convert my current pre-tax money over to a Roth option? My employer is going to start offering a Roth option for our 401k, and I want to take advantage of that. Great opportunity here awaits, Dontell. And I think there's a clarifying point that we want to start with when he says, John, convert my current pre-tax money. We want to be clear that if you're really talking about converting, that is moving the pre-tax money into Roth money. If you're just talking about changing where your future contributions go, that's a much simpler process, and we can talk about that, and we will. But let's talk about the conversion, because I'm not sure that's what Dontrell's really asking here, John, but if it is, we want to make sure we cover that.
So you've got an opportunity to convert traditional dollars to Roth dollars in either in a 401k or an IRA, and here is what you've got to understand about that process. You will owe taxes on any dollars that are converted from the traditional 401k pre-tax to an after-tax Roth contribution. So if you have, let's say, $50,000 in your 401k plan that you put in there before taxes, if you convert that to Roth, then you're going to owe taxes on that additional $50,000 on top of whatever taxes you're going to owe on your regular income. Now, if you've been getting a refund and you look like you're going to get a refund in the year that you make that conversion, then that refund may help you to absorb the tax impact of that conversion. But taxes will have to be paid. Now, what will not have to be paid is a 10% penalty. It's not like you're withdrawing the money out of the IRA environment. You're simply changing the designation from pre-tax to after-tax. And when you do that, the tax man cometh. He needs his money. And so the 10% penalty will not apply, but the tax impact will still be there.
Yeah, and that's why usually, Dontell, we would advise our clients who are thinking about Roth conversions to do it in bite-sized pieces for two reasons, because you're going to have to take that on as income and you don't want to convert too much and push yourself into a higher tax bracket, but you also want to be able to have enough cash on hand to pay the taxes, rather than you don't want to have to take it, you can't really take it out of the actual employer plan to pay the taxes, because you want to keep that money invested. So that's the conversion piece, and I would definitely not go that alone. It needs to be made, that decision needs to be made as part of an overall financial plan. But if you're just talking about in your question here changing, do I continue to contribute on the pre-tax side, or do I move it all to the Roth, or a combination of the two? Let's talk about that. The first thing I think you need to consider is, where is the employer match going to be made? You know, John, for a long time, the employer match was always going to be in pre-tax dollars. But yep, if Dontrell's employer is about to begin offering a Roth option, it's new and they're just creating this, they may actually be matching in Roth dollars.
Yeah, they can, under the Secure Act 2.0, make the match in Roth dollars. And that's a pretty cool thing. Now, a lot of employers don't want to do that because they have to pay the tax on that money as opposed to you. But it is certainly a match that you can actually, you know, figure out where that money's going to go. If you are going to leave that money in the pre-tax 401k as it is, then you can do that and just convert your money over. It really does depend on which direction you want to go with that, Scott.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that I would say consider here, if you, as far as once you've determined that your employer match is going to be made in Roth dollars and you want to go all Roth, it really comes down to me to age and income. Your income level matters here, because if you think about, if Dontell is in his later working years, he's in his 50s, maybe in his highest earnings years, the pre-tax may be more of a benefit because you're going to keep the taxes off now and pay them later. And typically speaking, you're going to be living on less in retirement. In other words, your income is going to be lower and taxed at a lower rate potentially than when you're in your 50s and you're in your highest working years. Transversely, if Dontell is in his 30s and he's making $50,000 or $60,000 a year, he's probably not in his highest earnings years, and he may more than likely be actually paying in retirement a higher tax rate. So it would make more sense then to put it all into the Roth
and grow that tax-free for retirement. And I think it makes sense, John, to think about age and income here.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. And Scott, the other thing that I think it makes sense to look at is look at the difference between a Roth 401k and a Roth IRA. The Roth 401k cannot access the principal without any penalty. Now, the Roth IRA does give you that opportunity to access whatever you contribute to that Roth IRA. You can access that without any tax or any penalty because you've already paid the tax on that principal and there's no penalty for taking it out. You can get to it anytime that you want to. So let's say that you have over the years made a contribution to your Roth IRA account of $50,000 and it's worth $75,000. You can pull $50,000 out of your Roth at any time, no tax, no penalty. But if that money has been contributed to a Roth 401k, then all of that money is in there and you cannot access it without a qualifying event and a early withdrawal penalty on that Roth 401k.
One final point to make before we move on to the next question. We really can't talk about employer plans without discussing contribution limits because we do know that they change. And in 2025, they have the overall cumulative 401k contribution. And when I say overall cumulative, that basically means that it is an aggregate amount, whether, Dontell, you decide to do it all pre-tax or all Roth or a combination of the two. If you are under 50, your max contribution is $23,500. If you are turning 50 or you're over 50, if you're turning 50 in the year 2025 or you're over 50 already, you now get a $7,500 catch-up contribution in addition. And new in 2025, for those ages 60 to 63, don't know why we stopped at 63, but it's 60 to 63 in 2025, the catch-up contribution is $11,250. So you get an additional catch-up above the $7,500 if you are 60 to 63. That's part of the Secure 2.0 as well. Dontell, thanks for the question. A reminder to all of our listeners and viewers that we have free resources available on our website, and you can download the 7 steps to unlocking financial independence by visiting getreadyforthefuture.com/steps. Our next question on the Get Ready for the Future show is from Jamie via email, and she writes, "My husband and I are concerned about healthcare costs in retirement. We've got a good amount saved, about $1.2 million, but our family has a history of lots of health complications in older years. What steps should we take now to be sure we're okay in retirement?" It's good that you're thinking about that, Jamie. We do know that healthcare costs are likely going to be the most exorbitant of any cost in your retirement years, and especially if you have some family history there to consider, you're going to want to make a plan for that. And I think, John, before we get to the future part of Jamie's question in retirement, there is kind of a good evaluation she needs to take, her and her husband both, of their current situation.
Yeah, at $1.2 million savings, then that's a good foundation for financial independence. You know, depending on what your income need is, I think that there's a good chance that you can sustain that income throughout your retirement with that amount of money. But you have hit on the big $64,000 question, as they used to say. Healthcare costs, we don't know really what those look like going forward. And I would say that you're going to need good coverage and a good emergency fund to try to not have to invade that $1.2 million. Think about that $1.2 million as kind of your milk cow. It's producing the milk. If you need a slice of beef for some reason, then you've got trouble in the milk processing department, right? You need to be sure that you've got that steady stream of income uninterrupted as far as your monthly expenses are concerned. You need to have an emergency fund, preferably after-tax dollars that are readily accessible to be able to cover healthcare costs. Now, that is out-of-pocket expenses, things like deductibles and coinsurance and things of that nature. You also need to be sure that you are providing for long-term care expenses. Those are all things that just on the surface, Scott, I think that's the evaluation that you've got to look at. You've got to look at acute care expenses, long-term care expenses. Acute care expenses can probably be covered with an emergency fund. Long-term care expenses probably need to be insured against.
Yeah, I would encourage Jamie and you and your husband to build a retirement income plan with a financial advisor so that you can know what that $1.2 million is going to do for you. Now, we don't know when you're going to retire. You may be years out, so we can project for you what that $1.2 million will become potentially with an assumed rate of return and your current contributions. And once you know your asset level, you can begin to see what your monthly income will look like. And you want to be able to dip into that retirement fund on a monthly basis and take monthly income. Maybe you can set that number a little higher than what you actually need so that you can begin to accumulate, as John mentioned, those after-tax dollars, because it's vitally important that if there's a healthcare cost that requires a lump sum payment, a big bill comes your way that something doesn't cover, you want to be able to attack that with after-tax dollars. And the easiest way to do that is to build liquid savings and cash that has already been taxed. Maybe it's been pulled from a retirement account over the years, or maybe you just had been able to save that in your pre-retirement years. But the other thing would be build up other after-tax accounts. If you have access to an HSA, a health savings account, start putting money into that now if you're not already, because you can pull that money out, John, tax-free for healthcare-related expenses.
Scott, an HSA is a great idea, and accessing an HSA after retirement is fine, but once you're on Medicare, you cannot contribute to an HSA. So that has to be done ahead of time. There has to be some forethought put into this. I think also, as we mentioned, long-term care insurance, it's important to think about what your options are. A less expensive option for long-term care insurance initially, as far as premiums are concerned, is traditional long-term care. Traditional long-term care is a lot like health insurance. You pay your premiums. The premiums are subject to increase. Those types of things. We have seen tremendous increases in traditional long-term care insurance. And so we at GenWealth have stepped away from recommending traditional long-term care insurance unless you just can't afford anything else. What we tend to recommend is a hybrid life insurance long-term care policy, because you know what your costs are, you know what your benefit is, it's very set, it's very calculated. There is no price increase that's going to come into play like it would on traditional long-term care coverage. Well, you may say, John, I don't understand why the two would be different. One is based on claims experience, meaning that if claims experience on traditional long-term care goes up, if more people are claiming against it, and baby boomers are claiming a lot on long-term care, then you're going to see those premiums go up. In terms of a life insurance long-term care policy, life insurance is very pre-calculated. It's very static. And what a long-term care rider essentially does is it gives you a prepayment of the death benefit prior to death to cover long-term care expenses. And so there's no magic as far as the formula is concerned there. They don't have to worry about claims experience because it's not an open-ended policy. When their claim expires, when they've used all of the life insurance, then there's no more money there. That is the downside of a hybrid policy. But you have to be in the game in order to get the benefit. And if you're not able to pay the premiums because the premiums on traditional long-term care have gone up, then that's going to be a problem down the road. You need to look at the hybrid option if it is an option for you.
Allows you to plan for the future when you know that premium is going to be level throughout. And I think the other piece to that is we like these policies too because they are for long-term care coverage, but it doesn't have to be a nursing home that you receive that long-term care from, because these policies will allow you to, if a doctor determines that you cannot perform two of the six activities of daily living, let's say you had a stroke and you can't bathe yourself or feed yourself, those would be two of the activities of daily living, and a doctor says, yes, that's true, in this case, Jamie cannot do that, then this policy would begin to pay a monthly income to you, and you would be able to use that however you choose to do that. So it may be that you're able to stay at home. You may be able to pay someone to come and take care of you. You may be able to pay a spouse to take care of you because the spouse had to quit their job or are limited on their hours because they are now a caregiver. So it's way more flexible, I think, than many of the traditional long-term care policies. But it is best to tackle that ahead of time. And the way the question is phrased, John, I think it's pretty likely that they're probably in good health now and they're talking about a future need. So when you talk about when we should address that long-term care and go in and try to get that coverage, all things being equal, if someone is pretty healthy or at least normally healthy, the age band is about 55 to 60.
Yeah, I would say that that's the best time to begin to think about doing it. The older you get, the more problems you have. The older you get, the higher the premium is on either of the policies. And so you certainly want to be sure to look at this from a affordability standpoint and an access standpoint. Speaking of access, Scott, I think that we also have to think about the fact that, you know, the presidential election has come and gone, and you have to think about what the Trump administration may or may not do as far as the Affordable Care Act is concerned. You know, there's a lot of provisions in the Affordable Care Act that make it beneficial for people who have pre-existing conditions. They are able to qualify for coverage, where I remember the day when you couldn't qualify if you had a pre-existing condition. You might get that condition ridered out of the policy, meaning that they excluded coverage on whatever that pre-existing condition was for maybe a number of years or maybe permanently. So there's a lot there that you know, you have to kind of keep a watch on as far as the politics of this is concerned. However, when it comes to Medicare and Medicare supplement coverage, you will not be denied coverage as long as you have a timely enrollment. And you want to be sure to check out what that is. It's usually 3 months before, 3 months after your 65th birthday, or after a qualifying event where maybe you've worked past 65 and you've had health insurance coverage and now you've retired. That retirement is your qualifying event to be able to get on to Medicare and a Medicare supplement without having to prove insurability.
If you're like Jamie and her husband and you're concerned about health care costs in retirement and you're not getting those questions answered from your financial advisor, let me encourage you to reach out to us. We definitely address that as part of our planning process. You can call toll-free 866-653-PLAN. That's 866-653-7526. And we will get you in touch with a GenWealth financial advisor to begin making your plan to address healthcare costs in retirement. In the meantime, we're going to name Jamie's question, the question of the week. And we're going to send Jamie a free Get Ready for the Future Show tumbler. All you have to do, Jamie, is email us to claim it. Send it to show@getreadyforthefuture.com. Next up, it's Justin from Bryant. How do you recommend preparing for short-term and medium-term savings needs? I've got my retirement plan set up, but what about expenses like my next car or helping a child purchase a home? Where should I keep that money? Well, that's an investment question, and it's a very good one, and we're going to get to that, Justin. But let's define first what you mean when you say I've got my retirement plan set up, because I do think very often people think their retirement plan is I have a 401k and I get an account statement and I'm contributing to my 401k. And man, in the last couple of years, it's been performing like gangbusters, right? And over a long period of time, I've seen some good growth. That's my retirement plan. If that is all you consider your plan, I would encourage you to dig a little deeper on that and look a little more granular. Build a written retirement plan to know if you're on track for financial independence. I think there's a great John Wooden quote, big fan of John Wooden, and many in this generation don't even know who that is anymore, but he was a legendary basketball coach for the UCLA Bruins. They won so many titles, I can't even remember how many. I think it was like seven straight back in the 70s. Bill Walton was a player for him. I got the chance to meet John Wooden years ago before his death, and I read a book that he gave me and signed, and he has so many great quotes. He has so many great quotes in that book, but one of the things that stuck with me that applies here is he said to his players at practice, don't mistake activity for achievement. And I think that's what people can get lured into doing, John, when they're throwing money to 401k. It's great they're doing that, but don't mistake activity for achievement.
Yeah, absolutely. Justin, you got to be on track for retirement. This is one of those situations where you've got to put your mask on before you start helping the person beside you. And so the retirement thing is a big, big deal. Now, let's go ahead and answer your question. If it really all depends on your time horizon, where you keep that money. Let's take a car as an example. It really depends on how long you're planning on keeping your current car. Some people trade every 2 or 3 years. Then if that's the case, then any money that you're going to set toward that new car probably needs to be in a money market account. A money market account has very little, if any, risk to it. It's a very stable type program where you can pull money from it and basically a moment's notice, sort of like a savings account in a bank, except for the FDIC insurance. And so a money market account gives you a good rate of return on money that you will need in the short term. But anything under 5 years probably needs to go in a money market account or a short-term bond fund. Anything over 5 years or 10 years or more, you can get more adventuresome with that, Scott. And I think that really kind of depends on where that falls in that 5 to 10 year time frame. But I would say at least if anything is over 10 years in terms of your time horizon of when you're going to need the money, you can go to much more of a stock and bond or a balanced type fund to try to get a little bit better rate of return.
Yeah, everything is about time horizon. And the reason for that is the more risk you take, there is the more potential for reward. But that risk can also lead to the loss of principal, at least in a shorter term. So if you have a goal that is 5 years or less, you don't want to put too much risk to principal. If you have 10 years, that looks a little bit different because we believe that time heals most wounds in the stock market. So if you have a downturn in year 3 or 4, we could give it plenty of time to recover. So I think working with a financial advisor, and that's the piece here I get to, Justin, is don't go it alone. Don't assume you know the risk reward inherent in any investment. Get some advice from a financial advisor, whether it's one of us or somewhere else. And I think it's also important to point out how to save for these upcoming purchases as well, because I think it's real easy for us to say, hey, pay cash for a car. You hear Dave Ramsey talk about that. And if you can pull that off, man, that is the best way to do it. Don't have an auto loan. But I know when you're younger, that is very difficult to do. And sometimes it gets lost in there. Hey, don't buy a car until you can pay for it in cash. Well, I can tell you firsthand, I've got a 21-year-old daughter. She just got married. She's finishing up college. And she had a car basically die on her. Her dad bought it for her. That's me. I bought her a lemon. I'm just going to be honest with you. It made it a while, but it's done. It's done for, and it's not safe anymore.
Bury that thing.
And I didn't want, and I didn't want her driving that anymore. And they are not prepared because they just got married to be able to pay cash for a car. But what I coached them in, John, was talking about, can you get some money down on it? Get the trade for the, it wasn't much of a trade, but you know, it was a trade. They gave her a little bit of money for it. So you can get at least a big chunk of it out of the way and then have a plan to not just make the minimum monthly payment. Don't bite off so much loan that you're stretched to have to pay that monthly payment. Make sure the minimum monthly payment's easy to do, right? And so you can go above and beyond that, accelerate the payoff of that auto loan. And I asked them, I said, how long do you think you'll be keeping this car? Well, if they think they're keeping it for 5 years and they can pay off a 5-year loan in about 2.5 or 3, they can continue to make that monthly payment because they're already used to doing it and build the next cash fund for the next car. And maybe then they can begin to have cash for cars as part of their repertoire.
Look, when you go to buy any big ticket item, cash is king. And if you got all the cash to pay for it, great. But even if you only have part of the cash, you still are in a much better negotiating position with that cash than you are going in saying, hey, could I get a loan for 98.6% of this thing or whatever? Yeah. You know, it puts you in a much better position. So cash is definitely the way to go. I think that, you know, obviously if you can, if you're trying to help a child purchase a home, as Justin kind of alluded to in his question, it's not your need or your goal, but it is your child's need. And so your financial independence, Justin, has got to take priority over the financial independence of your child. Having a paid-for home for a child is a great thing to do if you're financially independent already, but it's probably not a great thing to do to sacrifice your financial independence to facilitate that opportunity.
Our final question on the show, Ray, via email, how should my HSA funds be invested? Should that be a high-growth investment? We had a question about HSA or about healthcare costs, and we talked a little bit about an HSA in one of the earlier questions, but this from Ray is about, should I invest them? You know, we looked it up. Employee Benefits Research Institute reports that only 13% of people with HSA funds actually do invest them. And I would say that if you're putting money into an HSA and pulling it right back out, that's the right call. You don't want to put, back to our earlier question just a moment ago, you don't want to put the principal at risk if you intend to withdraw those funds and you're using them for healthcare costs now. But the great benefit of an HSA is that if you can put more than you need now into that account, you can grow it over time and have tax-free funds available to pay healthcare costs in retirement. So if that's a long time off for you, Ray, if you've got 20 years on your time horizon before retirement, then I do think a high growth investment is appropriate.
Scott, you know what works really well with an HSA if you have it available is the ability to do a bucketing strategy.
Yeah.
Where you have a little bit of the money in a long-term high growth type environment where you have some more money in more of a balanced environment and more money in a shorter term bond portfolio and maybe some in a money market account that is ready for you to access. Because during that 20-year time, you may have some healthcare costs that you need to pull some money out, and you don't want to have to be up against the wall if the market is down and have to sell an asset when that market is down and when you are at a loss in that asset. And so bucketing allows you to stretch out that timeline and allocate money from one spot to the other and be able to waterfall that money. If you spend down some of the money that you have in your short-term fund, then you maybe harvest some profits from the growth funds that you've had there and put it more at a ready for you to be able to be used. Investing is something that is very good for an HSA if you've got the money and you've got the time to make that happen. I think that the key there, Scott, as you mentioned earlier, is the relative time horizon of that person.
Yeah, and a couple of notes to finish up with on the HSA too that you should be aware of is, you know, you want to make sure that you're not so laser focused on covering your healthcare costs that you're cash poor, because you don't want to tap that money for non-health related reasons. Do not treat it as an emergency fund prior to age 65. Why? Because withdrawals would be taxed at ordinary income tax rates and penalized 20%. So you're giving away the money if you pull it out for a non-health related reason prior to age 65. Now, once you do reach age 65, it becomes a little more favorable. You can withdraw and use for any reason. It is still subject to ordinary income tax rates if it's a non-health reason, but you don't get penalized 20%. So it becomes more, just like about everything, it becomes more versatile later on once you get past those age mile markers, and in this case, age 65.
Scott, I might point out, and we know this because we're actually utilizing an HSA here at GenWealth with some of our employees. Those employees have opted into a high deductible healthcare savings program. That's why they have the option of contributing to the HSA, is because they have a higher deductible than the folks who are on the standard healthcare program. So the HSA does come with an additional cost there that you have to save money to backfill against that higher deductible.
Some great questions this week about those HSAs and about healthcare costs. Definitely a big piece to your retirement puzzle. And the overall written retirement income plan from GenWealth addresses that, as well as many other things. And you should be getting that from your financial advisor. You heard the bell there, John. We'll give you the final thought first.
Scott, you know, I think it would be easy for someone to kind of just take a look at GenWealth and go, oh, well, those are the retirement people. They deal with retirement income planning. They have the ready to retire process. But that's where you really kind of are led astray to some degree about the messaging there. Retirement is more than just producing cash flow income. Retirement is about things like taking care of healthcare costs, looking at things like, how is it that I'm going to pass this wealth that I have on to my family? How am I going to be able to deal with rising interest rates or rising inflation rates or whatever the case may be? You've got to look at all of the aspects of retirement, not just the income planning. And so that's why at GenWealth, we are comprehensive in our planning. Yes, we do lead with the retirement income plan, because unless you can pay the monthly bills, a lot of that other stuff doesn't even matter. So we're going to get the foundation taken care of first, and that is providing regular, predictable, dependable income to you on a monthly basis in retirement. And then we're going to address all of the other things that may be on your mind as far as retirement is concerned.
We know many of you listen to the Get Ready for the Future show on radio or on podcast. You may not be aware that we have a YouTube channel. And you can subscribe to it and get exclusive content you can't find anywhere else to help you discover, protect, and share true financial independence. All you have to do is search for Gen Wealth Financial Advisors on YouTube. Subscribe to our channel and get started today with all of that. And that is all of the time we have for this week's Get Ready for the Future show. As always, we thank you for being a part of it with us. And if you have a question, get it to us. Don't be shy. You can leave a voicemail or just shoot us a text. The number's 501-381-5228. Any money-related question, we're here to answer, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Get Ready for the Future show. If you enjoy hearing from the Gen Wealth team every week, make sure and subscribe to the podcast. And if you want to help us get the word out on building toward financial independence, share the podcast with your friends and family. The Gen Wealth financial team is available to you 24/7 at info@getreadyforthefuture.com or call our offices at 866-653-PLAN. That's 866-653-7526. You should personally consult a financial advisor before making any investment, and no strategy can assure success. Securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA/SIPC. Investment advice offered through Independent Advisor Alliance. Independent Advisor Alliance and Gen Wealth Financial Advisors are separate entities from LPL Financial.